You're listening to a download from the outdoorstation.co.uk. Number 422.
Hello and welcome back once again to the Outdoor Station. And I sit here on a very frosty morning with just a day to go until the end of 2016. So we're in that lull between celebrations. The thrill of Christmas has probably already dissolved into a distant memory, and everyone has anticipation of their own New Year's celebration. Be it a quiet meal in, a party somewhere noisy, or even camping in solitude somewhere up on the frosty hills, toasting one year out and another in. I know many, many of our listeners actually do this, so hopefully this podcast will keep you company and help pass the time as the stars start to come into view. We are, of course, in this podcast continuing our conversation with outdoor author and journalist Alex Ruddy, who explains his journey to a lighter approach, walking in the Alps, and how he took that lovely nighttime shot you can see currently on his and our website. Talking of which, all the links to everything we discuss on this podcast and the previous one, 421, are of course over on theoutdoorstation.co.uk. Well, apart from the UK hikes and the backpacking trips, which obviously you've enjoyed and written about on several occasions, you've also been to the Alps and the tour of Mont Rosa?
Yeah, that's right. Tour of Mont Rosa in the Alps. I've been to the Alps a few times. My first trip was actually in 2007 with my brother James. We went on a couple of climbing-focused trips. So back in those days, we were much more into climbing than we are now. And 2007-2008, we went to Zermatt and Chamonix and did some of the 4,000 metre peaks in the area. But since then, I've been focused on the walking potential in the Alps. And the Tour of Monte Rosa, I did that last September. And what it essentially is it's a Swiss and Italian version of the popular Tour de Mont Blanc, which is a circumnavigation of Mont Blanc. And the Tour of Monte Rosa is a circumnavigation of the Monte Rosa Massif, which is the highest mountain in Switzerland. And Monte Rosa has always been a favourite mountain of mine. It's quite an enigmatic hill. There's a number of different sides to it, but it's not a single defined summit. It's a very large, sprawling kind of mass of peaks. And if you look at the map, the Tour of Monte Rosa is a really appealing route. It starts and finishes in Zermatt, which is a popular centre for outdoor activities. And you can either go clockwise or anti-clockwise. I chose to go clockwise. And it basically just follows several valleys round, crossing over several cols. You've got a glacier crossing in there. It's just really good. And another reason it appealed to me is because James Forbes, one of the characters in The Athol Expedition, my book, he actually did part of that route in 1842. He did a grand tour of the Alps. I think it was about 500 miles in total. And the last section of his grand tour was a portion of the Tour of Monte Rosa.
And how easy is it to actually, I mean, getting to Zermatt's fairly straightforward, but to actually do a tour like this, is it you have to stay at mountain refuges, mountain huts and that type of thing?
It depends how you approach it is the short answer. I didn't stay at any mountain refuges. I wild camped. Now, the situation with wild camping in Switzerland and Italy is a grey area. It's not like Scotland where you've got guaranteed, you know, the guaranteed right to wild camp. In Switzerland, depending on who you ask, some people say, yeah, it's allowed in the Alpine zone. Other people will say it's not really allowed. I asked when I got to Zermatt, I went to the mountain office and I say, look, can I wild camp on this trail? And the guy I spoke to said, yeah, that's absolutely fine. So long as you camp, you know, above tree line, not near any refuges. And so long as it's kind of dusk to dawn, that's just fine. So you based on the information that I was given, you are allowed to wild camp the route.
I see that it's about, what, 190 kilometres long, something like that?
Yeah, that's right. I mean, I tend to think in miles, and it was, according to my records that I made on the way, it was, I think, 101 miles, so whatever that is in kilometres.
So did you find it, was it like a week trip and fairly easy? I mean, compare it to obviously walking in Scotland, was it easy going or was it, you know, really tough?
I'd say it's both easier and harder for different reasons. It's easier in that pretty much all the paths are very well marked. You're not really ever walking off trail like you will in Scotland a lot of the time. You can probably do most of it without a map, to be perfectly honest. I mean, large sections of it are way marked with, you know, metal signs and frequent kind of blazes on rocks. There's a, I think it was a white and red particular mark that you get to mark the Tora Monte Rosa. And the network of trails in Switzerland and Italy is great anyway. I mean, they've got a really good network of walking trails, but it's more difficult in terms of the sheer effort involved. I mean, in Scotland, in order to climb 2,000 metres in a day, you've got to be kind of enchaining multiple Munros, so kind of, you know, one of the more difficult TGO challenge routes, perhaps. You might get that kind of ascent, whereas on the Tora Monte Rosa, it's 1,000 to 2,000 metres every single day, regardless, you know, and that's just the normal route, and that's not going over any major summits. So you've got to be fit to do it, but the navigation's really not a problem. It's the kind of route where you can more or less just switch off and get on with it.
Right. I mean, I understand they're very keen about keeping you on the route as opposed to letting you wander off it as such.
Yeah.
But the sort of equipment that you would use on something like that, is it very similar to your, you know, a hiking trip in Scotland?
Most of the items I took with me were similar or the same items to what I took on the Cape Wrath Trail that year. So in 2015, I was really making an effort to lighten my pack. And at that time, I was using a tarp tent notch as my main shelter, which is really well suited to the kind of weather I was getting in the Alps. You know, it's a lightweight shelter. I think it weighs about 600 or 700 grams, and it's got a full inner with mesh, which I didn't really need. I could easily have got by with a trail star or even a less sturdy tarp. And in terms of the rest of the gear, the weather tends to be either much better or much worse than Scotland. So I'd say it's not as consistently bad in terms of wind and rain much of the time. You'd have to be unlucky to get that, I think, in the Alps in the main hiking season. But you do frequently get big mountain thunderstorms like you would get hiking in the USA, say on the Pacific Crest Trail, and they cause some problems for me. So although most of the time the weather's nice and hot and sunny and you can get by just walking in shorts and T-shirt and trail shoes, occasionally you'll get massive thunderstorms with snow and everything else. And in those occasions, it's a bit scary hiking in lightweight gear, kind of above, you know, 2,000, 3,000 metres or whatever. Mm. But you know, it works fine.
Yeah. Well, I mean, what about the practical things like, obviously, water? I presume water is in fairly good supply. But things like either resupply or eating at huts, is that how you would normally do something like that?
Resupply is really easy on the Tora Monte Rosa. So you can eat at huts if you want to, and particularly if you're staying at huts, they will supply more food than you can eat. Alpine huts are great for that. You know, they'll give you pretty much limitless courses of food in the evening, normally lots of pasta. But the Tora Monte Rosa drops down to a village or a town pretty much every day. So I didn't ever have to carry more than 2 days of food with me, which was fantastic. So you can hike with a nice light pack. Water was actually a little bit more scarce than I anticipated on several sections. So although there are streams and rivers all over the place in the Alps, some of them, the ones that come directly off glaciers, they're often full of silt, and you have to be quite careful drinking that. You don't normally need to filter water in the Alps unless it comes off livestock, you know, land with livestock on. But if you get glacier water with silt in it, it can bung up your filter and it can cause stomach problems. So there were a couple of times where I came across a water source and the water was literally milky white. I thought, no, I'm not going to touch that. I'll go to the next one. And I think there was a section where I had to hike for about, it was probably only about 20 miles between water sources, but it was a little bit further than I anticipated.
With your journey to backpacking from mountaineering, I suppose, would I be right in saying that it's been a fairly condensed period of time that you have adopted backpacking generally and gone through a range of gear, starting, as you said earlier on, with a big pack, possibly, 5-6 years ago, and actually reducing it down to what we'd class a standard lightweight system now?
Yeah, it has been a short period of time, pretty much about 6 years, really. I mean, if you look at what I was doing in 2010, I was mainly into kind of easy climbing alpinism at that time, but increasingly aware that I wasn't finding it as enjoyable as I used to, and I was wanting to get more into backpacking. So in 2010, I did a trip to Jotunheimen in Norway, which is a large, I think it's a national park, but it's a large area of kind of 2,000 meter peaks. And I really wanted to do a wilderness route, essentially, just to get back into backpacking after a few years not really having done much. And I took a really big pack with me. It was, I think it was my Hagloff's pack that I still have. It's a 60, the Matrix 60, and it was absolutely crammed. I weighed it before I went, and it was, I think it was 18 kilos without food, which is, you know, pretty heavy for a summer pack nowadays. And so obviously, I was behind the curve at that point. In 2010, lightweight backpacking was, you know, if not mainstream, it was, you know, it was everywhere, basically. And I wasn't reading any of the backpacking blogs. I was basically just doing what I'd always been doing. And on that trip, I really, really felt the weight of that pack, you know, because, again, there was a lot of up and down. It was in the middle of nowhere. I was having to be quite self-reliant, and my gear wasn't really performing as I wanted it to. I was hiking in big boots that gave me terrible blisters. My shelter was a Laser Competition, which was kind of my first concession to the fact that I wanted to get a lighter pack, but it, you know, I didn't go anywhere near far enough. And when I got back, I thought, you know, I need to start making changes. And in the next couple of years, I did make a few changes. I got rid of a few things. I experimented with trail shoes, but it didn't really begin until late 2014, early 2015. So very, very recently. And that's when I decided, you know, I want to do the Cape Wrath Trail. And I looked at the route and I looked at what I was using on the trail, and I thought I need to make some drastic changes. So that's when I got the Tarp Tent Notch. That's when I started hiking in trail shoes. And I've got a ULA circuit rucksack as well. So in getting that smaller, lighter rucksack, that was my kind of statement to myself, right, I need to make sure everything can both fit in that and is comfortable to carry.
Have you noticed that the transition to the sort of lighter end of the equipment range that you've chosen has enhanced or reduced your enjoyment? The weight aside, the actual functionality of how you perform during the day, has it increased your enjoyment?
I think that's an interesting question. I think in most respects it has, because it's in adopting a lightweight attitude and lightweight equipment, it's forced me to reevaluate the trips that I do. And it's not just about carrying less. Quite often the lighter gear is just better. So for example, I'm now using a Trailstar as my main shelter. And although it's not the very lightest, it's still, you know, a lightweight shelter that a lot of people use. And it's just better than any other shelter I'd used. So it's far and away better than the Laser Competition for the kind of stuff I do. And I just love the fact that you've got a huge amount of usable space. It's very, very simple to put up. It's incredibly wind resistant. And that's just one example. For example, the Trail Designs Caldera cone. I've got a titanium one. It's a lightweight piece of equipment, but it's also, again, just better than the stoves I was using before. You know, I was using lightweight gas stoves, and I was getting annoyed with having this big box full of half-empty gas cartridges in the garage, and that eliminates that problem while being very wind-resistant as well. So, and of course, the main thing, hiking in trail shoes, that's been a total revelation. No more blisters.
Tell me about the first time you did that. Did you feel the first day out that you were going to have issues and you were concerned about your feet and this wonderful thing that has never been described properly, ankle protection?
Well, I think that's it was a bit of a learning curve. So as far as I recall, my first trip with trail shoes on the hill was to Kinder Scout in the Peak District in early 2015. And I was a little bit nervous about it because although I'd used trail shoes on and off in the hills, mostly for kind of approaching climbs, I'd never used trail shoes with a big pack before. And that's what I was finding a little bit challenging at first, because I did kind of buy into the ankle support myth, but it was fine. You know, I was using Innovate Rocklite 295s. I think Chris Townsend recommended them to me, and they were very, very comfortable. I did my circuit of the around Kinder Scout, and I didn't have any issues with ankle protection. It was fine. And getting wet feet was a little bit annoying at first, but soon you realize that it's better to get wet feet and just let them dry. And it's because they're not wet and hot and rubbing. That's what caused the blisters in my boots. Because as a lot of people have come to realize, in traditional boots, the water gets in and then it doesn't get out again. It's very, very difficult to dry. And that's what had always been causing blisters for me. And I think that's what led me towards climbing and away from backpacking when I first got into the outdoors. It was the fact that when I'd go backpacking for more than a few days, I inevitably got blisters, and it didn't occur to me to try different footwear. So yeah, it was a total revelation, you know, being free of blisters. It's transformed my experience on the trail.
Yeah. I think everybody has an epiphany moment like that, to be honest.
Yeah.
Every month, we're holding a special competition where you can win some fabulous outdoor gear. It's a great way to support the Outdoor Station. The more entries we get, the better the future prizes. During the month of December, the prize is a complete hammock camping setup by DD Hammocks. And this includes a Multicam Frontier hammock, a Multicam 3x3 tarp, the tarp DVD, 30 metres of Multicam cord, and to finish off your hammock camping look, a DD sweatshirt, a DD t-shirt, and a DD cap, to a total combined value of £158. Simply answer the following question and text in your A, B or C answer before the closing date of the 31st of December, and you will be automatically entered. You can enter a maximum of 5 times from the same UK registered mobile phone number. So this month's question is, the mountain Ben Nevis is located in which country? Is it A, Scotland, B, England or C, Wales?
To be in with a chance of winning, all you have to do is text OUTDOORS and your answer of A, B or C to 82055. Or post your answer with your name and contact phone number to Competition, The Outdoors Station, Unit 19 Signet Business Centre, Hanley Swan, Worcester, WR80EA. Entries are open to anyone aged 16 plus, and you must have the bill payer's permission. Texts cost £1 plus your standard network rate, and the competition closes at the end of each month. Entries received after that date will not count, but you may still be charged. The winner will be contacted within 3 days of the competition closing, and they may appear in future programmes. For full rules plus terms and conditions, please go to theoutdoorstation.co.uk/competitions.
Cool. So looking at the rest of your gear then, I think you pretty well described what you use on a fairly regular basis. Is there anything that you're lusting after yourself, or you feel that you want to experience?
Well, I think the next thing for me is going to be a proper bathtub ground sheet for my Trailstar. So 2016 has been my first year using the Trailstar, and I've already explained how great it's been, but I've been using... I think it's Wix window film or something. It's Polycro anyway. It's a Polycro sheet. It's a lot of people seem to use it, and I use that as my ground sheet on the West Highland Way and the Alder Trail and the Skye Trail, and in the Pyrenees when I went to the Pyrenees this year as well. And it's fine when you have a great pitch, but the problem is when you just have to camp somewhere really damp and squidgy. And I've started to think, you know, maybe I want a bathtub ground sheet, particularly as I'm probably going to be going to some fairly damp places next year. So that's going to be next on my list.
So that aside then, what about your, so you said about the cooking, but what food types do you generally enjoy? Do you take commercial foods, or are you a dehydrator and actually dehydrate your own?
This is somewhere where my habits haven't really changed that much. I normally just take things like, you know, the pasta and sauce packets that you get in supermarkets that, you know, it's kind of like cheap dehydrated food, I suppose. I often have those and a combination of things like Mountain House dehydrated meals and Tracker bars and stuff like that. I've thought about dehydrating my own food and I would like to try it out. But at the moment, I think I kind of have the mindset when I'm on the trail that food is just kind of fuel to keep me going. I'm not really that bothered too much about having good quality food on the trail, which is possibly not ideal, but it's what I've been doing so far.
So the equipment that you're using for your photography, I believe it's a Fuji X-T1?
That's right. At the moment, I'm using the X-T1.
In your, just like I asked Chris, really, what is your equipment, your photographic equipment when you actually travel then? Do you take a small tripod or anything like that?
Yes. When I started taking my mountain photography seriously in 2015, I realised, you know, I would need a small tripod for taking the self shots. And I got, it was a Pedco Ultrapod 2, which was a very small folding tripod. And I've used that with varying degrees of success. The problem with it is that when you're using a wide angle lens at ground level, it's kind of difficult to get a good composition without just the foreground taking over. So you normally have to find something like a boulder to prop it on, which isn't a problem a lot of the time, but particularly in winter trips where you've got a lot of other things to think about anyway, I've come around to the view that I'm better off just taking a full height tripod. So I've more or less made up my mind that for all future trips, I'm going to be taking my full height tripod, which obviously adds a fair bit of weight. It's not that heavy as tripods go, but it's still 700 grams, which is, you know, it's a heavy item, but I think it will really help. And on the trips where I've taken it, I have come back with better gear. So yeah, the tripod's an important part of it. The X-T1 itself has really made a big difference. I upgraded to that from the Fujifilm X-E1, which is one of Fuji's older mirrorless cameras. And the main difference is for me with the X-T1 is it's weather resistant. So I don't have to worry about completely destroying it in kind of, you know, winter Cairngorm weather or in a rainstorm, anything like that. And with a weather resistant lens as well, it offers a lot of peace of mind.
And so do you just take the one lens?
At the moment, I'm taking two lenses with me. I've got a 35mm prime lens and either an 18 or a 12mm prime lens. So they're the two wide angle lenses. And the 35mm is just a kind of a normal lens. Last year, I was mainly using a zoom lens, but I've never really liked zoom lenses. My photography style seems to favour having a prime lens, so kind of forcing yourself into that one perspective. And if you want a different one, you have to make the deliberate step of changing your lens. So obviously that has the downside that you have to change your lens. So if the weather is bad, there's a very real risk of getting, you know, damp air or even rain into the camera body. But for me, having that 35mm prime lens and the wide angle, if I want it, is better. But I wouldn't ever carry more than two lenses just for the weight.
To be honest, one of the reasons for exploring these questions regarding the camera gear was you posted a photograph just recently, which is the lovely nighttime shot of, I believe it's you standing next to your trail star. And I'm just curious to know how you actually set that shot up, because it's a lovely exposure.
Yeah, it's my favourite photo from the year. I mean, as I wrote on my blog, it's not the best photo from a technical standpoint, but it's been received very well when I post it on social media, I think, because it's very simple and it tells quite a powerful message. It's just, you know, a person standing there next to their tarp in front of the aurora, and that's what it means to me. But in terms of setting it up, it was a bit of a faff, really. I was on the Loch Arbour Traverse in March this year, which is a traverse of the Grey Corries, the Annex and Ben Nevis, and I've been wanting to do this for many years, pretty much since I started walking, really, and I'd always waited for the best conditions, and the right conditions materialized this year in March. So I took the train up to Fort William, and I hiked up to the ridge top, and I wasn't actually using my trail star on that trip. I was using a poncho tarp simply because the forecast was just so good. I knew I could get away with it, and, you know, it was obviously very light. And I'd pitched on a flat bit of ground just beneath the ridge. And I'd had a nap basically when it got dark, and I set my alarm and woke up in order to do some nighttime photography. And I didn't really have high hopes at first because the moon was out and it was obliterating a lot of the stars. But when I took a photo towards Ben Nevis, I noticed a bit of green tinging in the right-hand side of the shot. And I thought, what's that? And I just happened to look round, and there was the aurora right there. And I thought, wow, this is amazing. I'd never seen the aurora from a mountain in Scotland before. So I had my little small tripod with me. I set that up next to my tent. It was unfortunately the same level as the tent, which I found annoying at the time. And I set my lens to, I was using the zoom lens, I set that to 18 millimeters, and I fired off a few shots. But one of the other reasons I got rid of that zoom lens is it's very difficult to manually focus it at infinity, which you need. Or, well, it's actually difficult to manually focus that lens at any kind of distance, just because of the way the lens works. So I had to set the aperture larger than I would have liked, just to make sure I had enough depth of field to get everything in focus. So I needed a very long exposure, and basically I just had to do lots of test shots until I got one that looked even vaguely good. But even so, there's a bit of subject blur in my head. You know, I'd moved around a bit and it's not quite as sharp as I'd have liked, but you know, the picture works at the end of the day. That's the important thing.
So the light inside the tarp then, was that a bit of light painting with a head torch?
Yeah, I think it was my Petzl light. I always carry that as a backup head torch. I literally just stuck that inside the tarp just to illuminate it, because you know, it needed a bit of extra light in the tarp just to give it a bit of colour to it.
Oh, lovely. Okay. Yeah. Well, I mean, your career, I suppose, yeah, your career is obviously developing interestingly now, developing yeah. nicely. And we've talked about the discipline of actually writing the articles and making notes as you go along. But the other side of it these days is obviously, apart from correlating all the information and creating the pieces about the subject matter you've chosen, is also the social media as well, because I noticed that your name crops up on many forums and other people's blogs and yeah. And the various social media networks these days. How do you find the discipline of keeping on top of keeping your name out there? That must be pretty tricky for somebody in your position trying to move forward all the time.
Well, in a way, but I enjoy it, to be honest. I mean, I really like Twitter. That's my platform of choice. I've always preferred Twitter over Facebook, and I often keep it in the background as I'm working. I know it's not really a great idea. You know, you should be focusing on work as you're working, but I often have it on my second monitor or whatever, just to keep it ticking over. And I find that it feeds into itself. So I'll post a few things every day, and I'll get involved in other conversations, and over time, you know, it gradually grows from there. And I found there's a very large and quite engaged community of outdoor people on Twitter, especially lightweight backpackers. You know, I talk a lot with a lot of the TGO Challenge crowd, even though I've never actually done the TGO Challenge. I'm often involved in those conversations, and there's Facebook as well, but I don't find it quite as useful. I do have a Facebook page that I post to, but there's far less engagement there. And, you know, kind of focusing on Twitter and a few forums every now and again, it keeps things going.
Well, you've listened to my previous interviews, I know, so therefore you know the question that's coming next. And your final question is, of all the things that I could have asked you about your career in writing and obviously where it's going for you, what should I have asked?
That is a tricky one. Maybe what you should have asked is, why didn't you start outdoor writing earlier than you actually did?
And what would your answer? And what would your answer be? You're too interested in climbing, surely.
Well, I think my answer would be, I had to grow up first, to be honest. Because yeah, I'm 30 years old now, and when I was at university, I already at that point, I knew that I wanted to do outdoor writing in various forms. You know, at that time it was fiction, but I knew I wanted to write about the outdoors. But I think I was too focused at that time on what I thought other people thought I should be doing, if that makes sense. So, you know, I was doing a degree in computing science, and that was the kind of general direction I was being pushed in. You know, people around me said, you should be focusing on coding Java, on learning HTML and stuff like that. And it took me quite a number of years before I realized that just wasn't what I wanted to do. And, you know, when it was the move up to Glencoe that made me kind of really focus on developing my outdoor skills, and then writing my novels that made me focus on developing my writing skills. And it was that eventually led me to my outdoor writing. So yeah, I think I had to grow up first.
And do you find now that you've managed to find the right balance between your love and interest in technology and social media and actually unplugging and going for a walk?
Yeah, I think I have, really. I mean, in a way, living in Lincolnshire, which is far from the hills, really helps, which you might not expect that. But the fact that when I'm down here, I can focus on work, I can focus on writing and my editorial business as well. And then when I go to the hills, I can focus purely on enjoying the mountains. And I mean, even though it's obviously all work as well, I think I've developed that balance far better now than I ever have done in the past.
My thanks, of course, to Alex for taking the time to join us and being so open about his writing career. He's obviously equally passionate about his writing and his mountains. So, here we are at the end of 2016. The time all of us generally make plans, make changes, and make lots of promises to ourselves. I've shared some of our journey this year as we have now moved home and are in the process of establishing a new base for our outdoor activities and production work for 2017 and beyond. Once we're settled and Mr. Openreach has finally erected a telegraph pole at the house, you will see and hear much more outdoor-related material being produced on a regular basis. It all takes time, effort and planning, and of course money, but in the end, I hope the format will appeal to the majority, as our audience is already steadily increasing, indicating that we're holding our own in the social media world. So this brings me to the end of this podcast, and I wish you, your family, and those important to you a happy, healthy, and companionable Outdoors 2017. So until next year, folks, bye for now.
Thank you for listening to this podcast. To hear or see more from our extensive free library, please visit theoutdoorstation.co.uk.